Welcome to the Forbidden Apple Podcast, where we explore the relationship between queer people and religion.
They say faith can move mountains, and we wanna know what faith means to you.
Join our conversation as we discuss overcoming prejudices, find common ground, and celebrate our differences. A former Orthodox Jew
and a Spanish-raised Catholic meet weekly and sink our teeth into
the Forbidden Apple.
The Forbidden Apple.
Hi, everybody.
And welcome to another episode of The Forbidden Apple.
I am Alyssa Weiss.
I am Pelayo Álvarez.
And today we have with us
Frank Vignola.
Yeah, thank you for being with us.
I hope that's how you pronounce it. Thank you.
Yeah, that's how you pronounce it. Frank Paul Vignola, last name. You could pronounce the G, or you could be fancy and say Vignola, which is probably how my ancestors used to say it.
We're happy to talk to you. It was really fun when we did the pre-interview, so now I'm happy that our listeners get to hear you.
Well, I'm really excited to see what you have to say to what we have prepared.
Frank is a life coach, by the way. Just dropping it there. Since we talk a lot about also religion and all of that stuff, we wanted to talk about your upbringing a bit. You did grow up in a religious household, right?
We didn't really go to church that much, but I went to Catholic school. That was the thing. You know, I grew up in New Jersey in the suburbs as an Italian American. I did Sunday school for a little while. And by the end of third grade, I was expelled from Catholic school. And then I went to public school after that.
What got you expelled?
Just behavioral stuff. My parents were together, never married, but together until I was around five or six is when they separated. And that was ugly. It was really ugly. I had two sisters from my mother, so different fathers, but they were older than me. She brought them into the relationship. When I was born, they were there. So they were my sisters. I grew up with them. Unfortunately, the way it worked out when they separated, my father got custody of me, but he couldn't get custody of them because they weren't his. So the family got broken up, but also the siblings got broken up. And that was really rough. And that was probably around kindergarten, first grade time for me. By third grade, it was starting to play on me in a lot of different ways. You know, add to that just some social awkwardness that I was experiencing. I was having trouble connecting with my peers, and I wasn't interested in the schoolwork, and I didn't do my homework, and I didn't listen. And then I became just obnoxious in class. I was defiant. After a couple suspensions, I eventually got expelled. They waited till the end of the school year, and they said, we'd prefer if you didn't bring your son back.
What happened after that? Where did you end up after you had to change?
I went to, there was another school. I was there for a few months, I think. But it was, you know, new faces, new teacher, new classroom, new peers. That was weird. But, you know, I had to adjust. And I was the new kid. I was there for a few months. My father remarried. And when he remarried, they moved. And then I had to change schools again. So then I went to another fourth grade class at another school, and I was the new kid again. Both public schools, I was there for fourth, fifth, sixth, and then about halfway through seventh, my mom got custody of me. So then I changed schools again. And then I was the new kid at another school. And it just got ugly after that. You know, high school freshman year, I was strolled out of my high school on a stretcher and 4-point restraints and sent to a mental hospital. And then from there, it was rehabs, mental health centers, shelters, group homes, halfway houses, juvie detention center. And then eventually I was in a place called Bonnie Bray for 2 years. And those were kind of like the last 2 years of a 4-year stint, if you will. And those were the ones that were the most impactful. That's when good stuff started to happen.
You went through a lot then. So a lot of moving and a lot of transition. Yeah. That's really hard. Do you feel like that was part of what led up to this? Because you mentioned when your parents got divorced and the behavioral stuff, but that continued. Is it part of that? The so much change, feeling like the new kid that you don't fit in, all of that stuff. Do you feel like it's your parents' fault? It's like, what did you do to me? Why did you do this?
It's so easy to think that way,
right? Yeah.
I think for some years, of course, I probably did. I don't feel that way now. I mean, was it partially their responsibility? You know, that I was moving from school to school? Well, of course, it's a legitimate question, but I don't look back now pointing any fingers or blaming. I kind of understand a lot of the things that both of my parents did and the choices that they made. They were young, younger than I am now. So, and I certainly don't feel like I have it all together and have all the answers. And when you're in an ugly situation like that, where there's kids involved and you're going through a separation, and you're trying to pick up the pieces, you don't always make amazing decisions. It's interesting because of all the things that I went through, that was small scale. I didn't realize the weight of it until, you know, later on in my life, when I was coaching more and more people, more and more men, and talking to them and understanding, you know, what it's like to go through a transition, even once, to be the new kid once, is hard. And I look back now and I'm like, damn, I did that. I don't even know how many times. It probably had a lot to do with why I struggled to connect socially with my peers. You know, I always thought it was just because I was an awkward kid and I didn't like sports. I was like a nerdy, creative kid. I didn't want to play in the dirt. That came later.
When you were moving around, do you remember the first tool from all this happening to you that you learned?
Not looking back, right? You mean at the time, the first mm-hmm. thing that I could legitimately say I had taken away from it? That's a good one. Because when I look back, I could see my process. I just don't know if I was aware of it as it was happening. I think
probably not. Yeah, those things.
No.
No,
not as a teen.
At this point, did you know that you were gay? And did that play into it at all?
Yes-ish. I had a girlfriend. And, you know, we weren't like just walking around holding hands. I was an early bloomer, but I definitely acknowledged even before that I had an attraction to guys. I think around 13, that's when I acted on it. I think I thought about it even earlier, you know, whenever, I guess maybe around 11, you know, puberty probably hit for me. And that's when I was like, you know, spending a little extra time in the bathroom. Fantasies ranged. They went back and forth. So I'd ask my buddies, have you ever thought about, you know, and they'd be like, yeah, I have. And I'm like, okay, all right, cool. They're thinking about it too. It's probably normal. For me, it wasn't enough to just think about it. Like I was like, no, I want to act on it. I never identified as being gay. I did, however, recognize that I liked men also. So yeah. And was it an issue? It certainly didn't make life easier. I wasn't getting beaten up for it, if that's what you mean. And it wasn't an issue at home. My family was much more concerned that I wasn't going to overdose on drugs or run away than who I thought I was attracted to.
So you went through a lot. That's like mm-hmm. a lot. And you said that you just had a lot of anger. Last time you spoke, you talked about how you found hope and that shifted everything. So talk to us a little bit about how, like, who helped you? How did you find this hope? Like, what was the turning point?
Yeah, sure. It was while I was in Bonnie Bray. I was probably there for about maybe a year. I had been there already when I met a staff member. It was this staff member and also a therapist of mine. Those two people, there were more. I don't want to take away anything from anyone who helped me, but there were two people in particular who I respected them. I felt like they accepted me the way that I was, felt like they understood me to some degree. I felt validated by them. And so I listened to them. So when they told me that they believed in me, when they told me that I was a leader, I believed them. And I discovered some of my strengths through that. And that gave me a little bit of self-worth. So it started there. Something I realized later was another thing that they both said that I needed to do in order to move forward, because I had so much anger, was I needed to forgive. In this case, that was my father. I have a great relationship with my dad today, but it was tumultuous then, to say the least. And it was holding me back, my anger and my hatred toward him and resentment. It was really, really holding me back. And one of the things that was pointed out to me was that denying the existence of my father was essentially denying part of my own existence, because he's a part of me and he's part of what made me. So by nature and nurture and a combination of the two, I am partially my dad. So you better come to terms with him because you're going to live the rest of your life denying your own existence. And it was never really articulated to me or framed that way to me before. And it really, it made me think. And yeah, so over many sessions with the therapist and a lot of work, I felt like I eventually forgave my dad. I look back now as the adult me, and I don't feel like there's a whole lot that I need to forgive my father for, because the adult me has a lot more wisdom and understanding and realizes that, you know, people do the things that they do and feel justified when they do them. So I don't fault him for any of it. But at the time, I needed to forgive him. So that was a big part of it. Simultaneously letting go of my past by doing that, so that there was, I could start seeing a road ahead. And that combined with some new self-worth that I didn't have before, and confidence, because I felt like a leader and I felt like I had something to offer. It gave me a sense of purpose. It gave me a reason to live, you know? In my teens, I wasn't looking for the meaning of life. In my teens, I didn't care about life or humanity. No, I was self-centered. I cared about me. I was a teenager. We're not fully developed. It was more, to put it more crass and simply, it was come up with one fucking reason why you shouldn't kill yourself. And then I got it. That gave me a reason, and it was a legit one.
Being a leader.
Yes. In my case, it was being a leader. But to generalize it into something that I think could apply to anyone, mm-hmm. it was discovering one of my strengths that I realized was useful and purposeful and would actually have some impact on the world and other people. And of course, the return and the byproduct would be confidence and self-worth and feeling good about myself. But there was something useful about it that I liked. And that really did something for me. That was where things started to change. That's where I started getting faith. Yeah, faith in my ability to persevere.
Yeah. And did you have any idea of like how this leadership was going to look? Or you just knew that that was your strength and then you built towards it?
I think I always knew that I would be in a position like I'm in now. I just didn't know that the title would be coach, which I think is so appropriate for the man that I see myself as and the man that I want to be. Back then, a life coach was not really a thing. So I probably envisioned myself as a leader in the form of perhaps a speaker of some kind and maybe a psychologist. The coach position feels like a perfect fit. It's a bit grittier. And I like the grittiness of being a coach. When you think of a baseball coach or a football coach, they're tough as nails. They can give you a lot of shit. They can knock you around and put you on your ass sometimes, but it's only to watch you get back up, and it's all rooted in love. It's always rooted in love.
Yeah, and you have people, it seems like the people that you actually respected were similar, had those strengths and those qualities.
Big time. And it's funny that you point that out, because I don't know if I ever made that parallel before. One was a guy and one was a woman. And they both were, I respected them because they were authoritative and tough, but they had the biggest hearts. And it's awesome to kind of see it through that perspective now that you pointed that out, because it's that had a lot to do with why I liked them as much as I did. They were a combination of really tough with a lot of love. It's funny because I think probably most of my clients would describe me that way today.
Do you remember the first time that you switched and you gave tough love to somebody that you cared about and you wanted them to grow?
I don't remember the first time that I did, but I can tell you that it happened when I was in the program, because shortly after I made that kind of discovery about myself, I had become a member of this Big Brother program that they had there, where essentially we were learning coaching skills and leadership skills. And part of that program was to implement it by coaching group meetings and group therapy sessions with the newer residents. So I had kind of like little brothers, sponsees, they were new residents who came in, and I was the big brother. So I was already doing it then.
And how much of your background do you share with your clients? Like, kind of say, like, cause you know what works, you know what doesn't work based on kind of what you went through. You kind of know the level, the amount of tough, like tough love and all of that. How much of your background do you share?
If I'm going to share something and I'm going to take away any of their time to talk about myself, it better be something that I think they're going to relate to, and it's going to lead them somewhere. Whether it leads them to simply just feeling validated, like, okay, he gets it, he went through it too, or it leads them to some discovery because it's like, oh, he overcame that, and maybe I can implement a similar strategy here.
What other techniques or skills do you use for coaching that you have learned over the years?
So I want to just get to know the person so that I can understand them in a really unique and specific way, and then tailor all of the things that I've learned over the years in a way that's specific to my client's needs. I'm a little resistant to this kind of five-step fix kind of mentality that I'm seeing with a lot of coaches. I think it's fucking bullshit personally, but I don't believe there's any like one five-step formula that we can just apply to all people and it's just going to make them all happy. That would be nice. So one of the things that I do is it's a combination of my formal training and then my years of experience as a coach, and then my years of going through the things that I just told you guys about. So my own wisdom that I gained from that, those three things combined.
As well, can I just add, which I found really interesting because you shared last time, acting techniques, things that you use in acting.
Yes, yes, for sure. Those three things combined are how I feel like I can step inside the shoes of a client and understand them. And for me personally, I know that problem solving is really important as a coach, and there are certain things that we can learn and certain skill sets that we can have in terms of helping people plan goals, helping people come up with a plan of action, accountability, etc. One thing, however, that I kind of pride myself on is the ability to understand people on a deeper level than most helping professionals. Yes, Melissa, totally. A lot of that has to do with my background in performing arts, and acting. Because you guys, I know you're actors too. Besides the things that we learned about getting out of our own heads and putting our focus on the other person and just, you know, being in the moment and working off of the person, active listening. And then add on to that the character work that we learned later about being able to understand people. While those things help me in the process of understanding people, there are other things that come up and other areas that have come up in coaching where I realized, holy shit, I could totally implement some of my acting skills and some of the things that I've learned in acting here. And I could teach it in a way where it can be applied to life. So one of the things would be emotional preparation. Actors have to do an emotional prep for the first moment of a scene, right? So if we need to self-generate rage before we enter the scene, you know, we have our maybe, you know, depending on where we are, if we're in a studio setting and it's a classroom environment, you know, we may be backstage with our headphones on listening to some, you know, Slipknot or something that's going to really get us amped and angry. But if we can't do that, then maybe we're just in our heads, you know, using a specific circumstance that we can think of that takes us there and brings it up. Same can be applied if a client has to self-generate confidence before he's getting ready to go give a presentation or before he's getting ready for his first date. Confidence is a big one. So if confidence is needed for a presentation and thinking about something with the presentation is not going to generate confidence for you, then we have to find out what will. You know, and I just asked them, so when was the last time you felt really confident? It always, not always, well, a lot of times it goes to sex. And if it doesn't, and they are struggling to find that time when they felt really confident, I will bring up sex. And it's like, it's just like, it's some little part of them like lights up a little bit. And as soon as I see them flush with a little red in the face, I'm like, this is good. This is good because it's doing something to you, you know? And then I take them to the confidence part. It's just like, what did you do? You know, how did that feel? This is what you need to use. You can use it. It's okay. You're going to go in there with a big grin on your face. You're going to go in there feeling good, and you're going to have self-generated, actual, real confidence. Not like you're going in pretending. No, you have generated real confidence.
Do you just, you coach men, right? That's your, you're like a men's coach.
I advertise myself as a men's coach, and I think that's my specialty. I like working with men for a few reasons. Yes, I'm a man, so I probably understand them on a deeper level. In addition to that, I was at a boys' home. It was an all-boys home. So the work that I do is it's rooted there, you know? So it, there's a part of it that just kind of feels right. It feels like I find that men in general struggle to seek help. I find that men are a little less likely to admit that there's something in their life that they feel that they can improve upon. So I want to give them somebody that they feel like they could look up to.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. Now that you just said you were in an all-boys place, I'm like, how was that with liking men? How was that? Because I was in an all-girl seminary, and there was like, everybody was hooking up with everybody. And I'm like, you were in an all-boys thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, no, I definitely had some fun while I was in those programs. And it was never a secret. I don't recall any place that I was in where I ever was silent about it. So, yeah, I had a few connections while I was there. I could tell you right now, though, at least at Bonnie Bray, I think there was, while I was there, only one other guy who was openly attracted to other men. So that became a part of my identity while I was there. And in a way where I was respected, actually, where it was like, oh, yeah, but Frank's, you know, Frank's like that, and Frank's cool. So it almost, and that continued, by the way, after Bonnie Bray. It continued with a lot of guys, you know, these kind of like blue collar type guys in the Jersey suburb. To many of them, I didn't fit the stereotypes. And I think that opened a lot of guys' eyes.
Your whole work is connecting with others. And I wonder how you started to trust, besides like getting this hope and you feel like you have the purpose, but to feel like you're part of something bigger and not this lone wolf that you were.
It's interesting, that question, because in a lot of ways, I do still feel like a lone wolf. But I don't know that it's bad. I do feel like I'm a part of something. I feel like I'm a part of humanity, and I love people, and I love connecting with people. That said, there is a part of me that I don't think will ever go away that still feels a little bit like the underdog, the black sheep, the odd man out, the loner, or in many cases, the leader. The leader and the loner can sometimes be one.
Yeah, that's a great way to see it, because that same qualities that made you the loner is now the qualities that making you the leader.
Who's the one coaching between those two, between the loner and the leader?
Oh, the loner and the leader.
And do you take skills from both of them, or you just like, is the leader the only one coaching?
No. Frank is coaching. Frank is coaching, and Frank is both. So yeah, it's definitely going to be both appropriately, right? So if somebody needs to hear from the loner, if they need to be validated by the loner, then he'll put on the coaching hat. I think it just depends. Probably more often it would be the leader. The leader and the loner, for me, are kind of existing simultaneously. Is that the leader is the loner.
Isn't that a saying? Like, it's lonely being on top or something?
That's nice. That's a really like glass half full way to look at it. Yeah, it gets lonely at the top. And listen, that's a whole different conversation, but that's a part of it too, is that you have to leave a lot of people behind on your way up. And that's something I've definitely taught people before, especially anybody coming out of a struggle where there were other people involved or substance abuse or anything like that. You're going to have to leave a lot of people behind because you're going to grow at a faster pace than them. And if they're holding you back, you have to let them go.
How do you coach people to leave something that they're comfortable with to grow?
I was talking about recently with a client, maybe a couple months ago, and he was talking to me about friends of his who were still into going out and, you know, beer pong and just getting smashed and doing stuff like that. And he wanted to do other things. He wanted to go skiing and snowboarding and take cool trips. And they just wanted to hang around and get drunk. And I said, basically what he told me was that he wasn't really doing the things that he wanted to be doing. A couple months later, we'll jump ahead. Here he has this new circle of friends that he found because he went to a meetup group that we talked about for people who live in New York but love to go snowboarding, and he's doing the things that he wants to be doing. So since he started doing those things and he started to see firsthand, you spend time around people who are on the same level as you or even a little bit ahead of you, because that makes you want to strive for more. They inspire you. They motivate you. You suddenly start living as if. You start doing the things you want to be doing to become the man or the person that you want to be, you know? And then the other thing to point out is that if you're many, many, many steps ahead, you may feel like they're pulling you back, but they may feel like you think you're better than them. So my job is to just articulate it in a way that they understand that and they can see it, or show them by saying, listen, go make some friends. Go make some friends who like snowboarding. You'll see what I mean. Give it a month.
We talk about faith a lot, and I want to know, like, what has helped you during these changes, during these lonely times of your life? How do you, like, keep balanced, if you have anything?
Well, the last conversation that we had helped me realize something that was really cool, which is that I do have faith. My faith is in my ability to persevere. It's the belief that, and the faith, that I can overcome anything, and that no matter how hard things get, I can always find happiness, because I've found happiness at the hardest of times, and that I will get through it and that I can overcome it. So that faith is my faith. That's what gets me through tough times. As far as my journey to get there, I bounced around, tried on a few religions for size to see if what worked. I mean, I can't say that I dove deep into too many. I've dabbled with a few. I mean, I considered paganism. I of course, because I was born Catholic, I tried Catholicism. I considered Buddhism. I played around with the idea of Wicca. I even visited Satanism. And I was just like, what's that about? Come to find out, it's not about Satan. Surprise. It's actually an atheistic religion. And I was like, oh, that's kind of neat. But no, none of them really worked for me. I found that being agnostic was the thing that made the most sense if I had to pick something to identify with.
So you have faith in yourself, and you said you have certain mantras, and I love the like simplicity of it. Can you share a bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah. These are mantras that I use when, I mean, I've used them in acting. I've used them when I need to prep for a presentation of any kind or a speech or anything where the stakes are high. One of the things that I use is fuck it or fuck them. It's so simple. But for me, what it does is it makes the other people less important. If I'm going out on stage to act, or if I'm going into a scene or whatever it is, and I'm preoccupied by my audience and thinking, I hope they like me. No, fuck them. Who cares if they fucking like you? Fuck them. Fuck it. And of course they're important. What do you mean fuck them? They're the reason you have a job, you know, but I can still believe it in the moment. What it's going to do is it's going to lower the stakes, and it's going to get me out of my head of being too preoccupied with the need to be liked. So it's not going to have a negative effect on my performance. My performance won't be distracted. So, you know, instead of I want to be liked, it becomes I can't wait to show you what I've worked on. And fuck it often gets me there. With affirmations, I tell people to speak to yourself in language that you would use, that you would normally speak to yourself in. If you Google a bunch of affirmations online and they're prolific and written like poetry, and you read them to yourself and you don't speak that way, you're not really going to believe it, probably. You have to translate it into language that you would use.
Fuck them.
Fuck them. Because underneath that, there's layers and layers and layers of shit that I know what it means. And I'm the only one who needs to know what it means.
Do you remember the first time that you, after all this, just I'm thinking, like, your parents must be super proud of you. And I'm wondering, do you remember the first time that you felt like, I make them proud? After all this, like 4 years of, like, you know, knowing you were difficult and leaving angry, you know?
One of the things that I do is I go back to Bonnie Bray and I speak to the boys. For my 10-year anniversary of being successfully discharged from the program, I was invited back to speak. And my whole family went. They were there and they got to see me speak. And a lot of the staff members who were there when I was a resident were still there. So they got to see me speak too. That was a moment when I was really proud of myself, but I think it was probably also a really powerful moment for my family because, yeah, you know, they were at the place where I was living, you know, they got to see it again and remember what I was like and where I came from and who I am now. So, and I felt it, and I felt it. Yes, I felt how proud they were of me. That was one of the times that I knew that my parents were really proud of me.
That's such a full circle moment.
But sometimes the very thing that makes us troubled, or whatever you want to call it, is also the same thing that makes us really fucking interesting. And I spent the first several years after having left Bonnie Bray silencing it because I thought it just needed to be silenced. And it wasn't until much later, actually, when I started my acting classes, that I realized, no, I don't want to silence it. I want to bring it back, actually. But now I know what to do with it. I know where to put it. I know how to use it. It's not gonna control me. I can control it.
Yeah, where can people get your advice directly and learn more about your services, everything that you have to offer?
So if you want to learn about my services, you can go to my website. It's masteredman.com, masteredman.com. Or if you're not necessarily looking for coaching, but you want to just follow along my crazy but fun journey of life, then you can follow me on Instagram at Vignolagram, VignolaGram.
No. Pretty catchy. Either one. I really like it.
Yeah.
Thank
great.
You.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll link it below so people can find you and follow you. And you're very inspiring. So I'm happy that people get to hear you. It's important, I think, that people know that you can overcome things. You can keep good parts of yourself and, you know, like, and get through it and then use that, like, find what you're good at and use that to help people as well. Use your background. I think that's really important.
110%. Yeah, it's what makes us unique and what makes us different. I'm really, really grateful that you guys let me do this and that you guys wanted to talk to me.
Yeah, grateful you accepted we're so happy, the invitation. Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been another episode of The Forbidden Apple. I am Melissa Weiss.
I am Pelayo Alvarez.
Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye.